Hello there, welcome to Tuesdays, I had to think about that. Richie Allen Radio Show, broadcasting live from Salford. How are you? I'm Richie Allen. I've got Right Said Fred on the programme, returning to the show, Richard and Fred. Can't wait to chat with them. Before that, though, we'll run down the biggest news stories of the day. Reach out to me via the website or via the Richie Allen Show app then.
Uncensored, unfiltered, you're listening to Richie Allen on the world's most popular independent news radio show.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Yes, they've sold 25 million records around the world. They've won Ivor Novello Awards. They've collaborated with some of the biggest acts in pop music history. Right Said Fred will be on the programme. And they were a tonic over the course of the last 4 years. They really were. So they were. And really enjoyed them being on the programme previously. Richard and Fred are back today. And around about a half an hour's time, they'll be on. So if you'd like to say something to them, you can do so via the messaging. I've already told you how to do it, so do it. And we'll have a good chat with the lads when they're on. In the meantime, lots to talk about. There always is. 25 million records, eh? Eh? That's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, that's unbelievable. Working with David Bowie, Mick Jagger, Taylor Swift, my God. Hey, listen. Chris Packham, you've seen him on the telly. He's a climate evangelical person. He's a climate change evangelist, TV presenter. He could be a decent bloke in real life, I don't know. But he believes that we're all going to die, we're all going to burn, we're either going to burn or drown amid climate collapse. So I don't know why he's even bothering. This is the thing, nobody puts this to them. They say it's inevitable. Well, can we just not enjoy ourselves then for a while? But they don't. Anyway, he says that Just Stop Oil, a load of grannies and aunties have got nothing else to do but glue themselves to the highways. He says they are right to protest the homes of MPs in the name of saving us all from the aforementioned fires and floods and climate collapse. Responding to this earlier today on Talk TV was Robert Darwall, author of a book called Green Tyranny. Here he is.
Where he's absolutely wrong is in saying that catastrophe is on the cards imminently, because it's simply not. If you look at the Working Group 1 report of the IPCC, of its contribution to the Sixth Assessment Report, if you do a word search, you'll find the word catastrophe or catastrophism. I think it's mentioned 5 or 6 times in over 1,000 pages. And Julia, the first mention is climate catastrophism as a media narrative. And that's what it's about. Yeah. This is a media narrative. Yeah. This is an activist narrative. It is not grounded in science. And as has been demonstrated time and time again, there is no trend in extreme weather events.
By the way, that's true. I'd love to contradict it, even though I think the idea of man-made climate collapse is utterly ridiculous. But I'd like to be, you know, to be fair. But there is no upward trend in what they call extreme or adverse weather events. There isn't.
And the person to go on to on that and Google it is Roger Pilker Jr.
Roger Pilker Jr.
Climatologist at the University of Colorado in Boulder, who's done huge amounts of debunking the catastrophist narrative.
He has. I've invited him on this program over the years, and he told me to feck off. Not in so many words. People from Boulder in Colorado, they don't generally tend to say feck off. Anyway, but he's a decent guy by all accounts. They've been making these ridiculous predictions about climate collapse going way back.
The other thing, Julia, in terms of there have been scientists, well-known climate scientists, who've made predictions of catastrophic events. One of the most noteworthy is James Hansen, the NASA scientist who set a lot of this off back in 1988, and he predicted Upper Manhattan would be underwater by now. I mean, complete bollocks, you know, absolute complete bollocks.
I probably should apologise for that language. Sorry, everybody, but I understand the sentiment.
She understands the sentiment. She has to apologise for the language. It was announced today, by the way, that Talk TV, which is where that clip originated, Julia Hartley Brewer and Piers Morgan and the rest of them, they're going to cease broadcasting on your traditional television. They're going off TV and going to move solely online. So they are. The BBC has been reporting on this today. The president of broadcasting for Talk TV briefed staff and said 2 years ago, we wouldn't have been brave enough to launch a channel without a linear presence. But audiences of all ages have moved fast and smartphones are now the primary device where news is consumed. We need to adapt to this as a priority. So they'll be coming off linear telly from early summer and they'll be focusing on streaming. Just in case, for people who don't understand Ofcom, if they continue Talk TV to broadcast in the way they did on traditional telly, in other words, with a linear schedule, breakfast, mid-morning, lunch, they will be bound by Ofcom regulations in any case, because Ofcom does regulate internet television in this country. It really does. Look it up. So that's an interesting development, I suppose, isn't it? Okay, it is. Shall we stay with the environment for a moment? BBC Radio 5 Live runs a daily feature. Sorry, the breakfast programme runs a daily feature, and it is entitled, In My Opinion. You will get activists campaigning for this or that. They will offer their opinion via a recorded message and then they are brought on for an interview. It's called In My Opinion. It's a neat little segment. Now, John Reid represents an organisation called Clean Up Britain. They are fed up of litter. The host is Rachel Burden. Have a listen to this. It's interesting.
Now, today's In My Opinion is all about tackling littering. And I think, broadly speaking, everyone's on the same page that it's not a good thing. I haven't had a text from anyone saying, nah, everyone has a right to litter, but it's how you deal with it. Well, picture this. Every drive-through meal you receive in your little paper bag is then marked with details linking it directly to your car. And if that package ends up being tossed on the ground, you will be hit with a fine. What do you think? Well, it's something that Clean Up Britain would like to see happen. John Reid is the founder of the organisation. Hello, John.
Hello, Rachel.
Can you talk us through, practically speaking, how this will work?
Very good. Practically speaking, I want you to pay attention to this and I want you to listen to how he describes how this might work, tracking people's litter. And I want you to imagine how it could be applied elsewhere. You get what I'm saying? Listen.
Yeah, absolutely. So you imagine you're in a queue going through a drive-through restaurant and McDonald's, and essentially as you're driving up there, your number plate is scanned, and you make your order, you drive through, pay and pick up whatever you've ordered. But actually in the intervening period, all the packaging which is going into your bag of whatever you bought has been scanned with the registration number of your car.
All the packaging, not just the bag?
No, all the packaging, everything. And so basically there's a digital footprint to everything you bought, the burger, the fries, whatever it may be. And obviously the whole idea is to send a very clear message to people that they have now bought that. That's their behaviour. And you know what? It's their behaviour that counts here, because they've got to be responsible about disposing of it. Unfortunately, as we all know from driving around the country, there is huge amounts of packaging, particularly McDonald's and KFC, but not just them, which is just very antisocially is flung left, right and centre, and which is environmentally polluting our country.
Wow. You got that, you did?
Yeah, no argument there. And I can see how it would work potentially if you've got the number plate on the...
What do you mean no arguments there?
...the outer bag. But if you're going to put it on every bit of packaging, aren't you then going to have to introduce all kinds of tech in these fast food places that they just don't have at the moment in order to have what is effectively personalised packaging?
Yeah, there will be an element of that. There's no doubt about it. There will be new technology and infrastructure costs, absolutely. And they'll have to be borne by the fast food companies. But it's a cost of business, cost of doing business like any other cost of doing business that people like McDonald's and KFC have to incur.
Yes.
It's as simple as that.
Madness. Have you been thinking about how you could apply that elsewhere? It doesn't take a genius, does it, to think about, well, let's introduce this technology to track every bit of paper back to the person who purchased the product, in this case, the McDonald's or Wendy's. I don't think we have Wendy's here in the UK. I've never seen it anyway. Or KFC. Imagine how that could be applied elsewhere. Think about carbon footprint. Think about consumption of other things. Imagine. It's crazy, isn't it? I thought you might be interested in that. That was John Reid from Clean Up Britain, on BBC Radio 5 Live this morning. No outrage amongst the listeners. The messages coming in afterwards were, yeah, this is a good idea. My God. Yeah, you suggest tyranny to them and they say, yes, please. Yes, please. Crazy stuff. Right, let's talk about something else momentarily. A government plan, talked about this today and yesterday, for a new definition of extremism has sparked concerns in the cabinet, the government's cabinet, that it could inadvertently penalise groups opposed to gay marriage, abortion or new transgender rights. The government wants to broaden the definition of extremism. And in my opinion, if the government wishes to do this, or at least those who control the government, they want to do it because if you broaden out the definition of extremism, you can call anything you like or label anything you like as extremist. And then you can ban, cancel or worse, anybody you see fit. Michael Gove, the community secretary, is expected to announce the updated definition of extremism next week as part of this of these plans to crack down on extremism. The Conservative Party MP, Miriam Cates, was on Times Radio today. You will hear the presenter first.
So I want to ask you one other thing, and this is the front page of the Times. Tories divided over a new definition of extremism. It's been decided that the definition of extremism, Miriam Cates, needs to be updated. Michael Gove is keen to do that. But some in the cabinet are worried that someone like you, for example, might be caught up in it, that you might be labelled an extremist because you are an individual, perhaps, who promotes an ideology that undermines the rights or freedoms of others. For example, if someone was a gender-critical feminist or if they had traditional Christian views. Are you concerned about this definition?
Is she concerned? Here's Miriam Cates then. What does she think?
I am concerned because I think it's very difficult to define extremism or indeed British values in a way that doesn't catch people with perhaps minority but perfectly legitimate views. And I think the gender critical feminist argument is a very good one. Lots of people have called me extreme for believing that there are just two biological sexes. I have called trans rights activists extreme for believing that you can change sex. And these are a perfectly legitimate arguments to have in a democracy and arguments that we should be having. And I think the problem is, if you are trying to address a very specific problem with Islamism and with threats that are being made to people and intimidation, which absolutely is happening and we definitely need to tackle. But if you try to address that problem by creating a broad definition of extremism, you can see how very quickly ordinary law-abiding people with perfectly legitimate views will be drawn into that and then not able to participate in society in the way that they absolutely should be.
Okay.
So I think it's very worrying to try and create this broad definition. And actually what we need to do is enforce the law as we have it. We do have very strong laws against terrorism, against promoting terrorism, against racism, against threats of violence, all those things that must be enforced. That has to be the way of tackling this, rather than, unfortunately, creating more problems with freedom of speech, freedom of expression.
Right, so don't update the definition.
That would be my preference, but okay. As I think it said in, I think it was Greg Hand said, we need to see what is actually being proposed.
Yeah, but because they've specifically said anybody who vocally or actively attempts to undermine the institutions of the UK, what does that mean? It's not really people who are arguing or squabbling over gender issues. It's far more serious than that. It's people questioning the legitimacy of governments, questioning the legitimacy of NHS policies, vaccines and whatnot. That is ultimately, in my opinion, where they want to go. This is the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live from the heart of Salford City in the northwest of the UK. I talked about this on the papers podcast today. The chairman of the BBC, the incoming chairman, Samir Shah, still making me laugh, has committed to attracting working class audiences back to the broadcaster by reflecting class and thought in all of its diversity after it, the BBC, was warned by Ofcom for failing poorer viewers. Shah, who's 72, replaced Richard Sharp, former Goldman Sachs banker. I know it still makes me laugh. He took up his role this week. He wrote to staff and said it was vital the BBC appeal to all audiences if it is to be the most trusted news outlet. We must be the home for showcasing the full range of British culture and talent, geographically, of course, but also in terms of class and thought in all of its diversity. You know who couldn't resist virtue signalling here? You can probably guess. A bloke who presents mid-morning radio in London called James O'Brien. He couldn't wait to virtue signal and stick up for the working class, and he completely missed the point, as most intellectually redundant people usually do. This is quite comical. Listen.
What on earth is a programme that woos a working class audience? Because I could be blind to this issue. I could be completely insulated from it. I could be an absolute victim of my own prejudices, privileges.
Jesus, he goes on, right?
Presumptions, call them what you will. But I'm going to say to you, I don't think there is such a thing as programmes for the working class.
We'll come back to that in a moment.
I just don't think it exists as a genre. I don't think there's a programme that I would only enjoy if I'd had a humbler upbringing or a more difficult upbringing. The idea that story, I mean, what's Charles Dickens? Is Charles Dickens, does Charles Dickens appeal to the working class? Does William Shakespeare appeal to the working class? What's Samir Shah got in mind? Sounds to me like, just as it's impossible to...
He might have in mind, and by the way, this came about because Ofcom criticised the BBC, he might have in mind ensuring that programming is real for people. Real for them, depending on their everyday experiences, the things they deal with, the things they go through, their environment. That's what they might mean. You know, you don't have to be a genius, really, to understand this, but this gets comical.
To really define what woke means, if you're using it as a pejorative, people trying to be anti-woke end up speaking utter bilge. The Royal Family, R-O-Y-L-E.
Here we go.
One of the best television programmes ever made.
It's not. It's very good, but not one of the best ever.
Do you have to be like the Royal Family to enjoy it? Do you have to live in a house like the ones that Jim Royle and his family? Of course. What on earth does this mean?
What does it mean?
So you are working class. Tell me what you think about the idea that there are programmes that can be made, that are made, that used to be made, which would appeal very directly and almost exclusively to you.
Oh, dear God, what a dick. What a dick. The Royal Family was created by Caroline Ahern, Henry Normal and Craig Cash. Caroline was born in London. Her father was a railwayman. When she was two, they moved up here to Withenshaw, right? Craig Cash, working class estate in Stockport, not too far from here. Henry Normal, whose real name is Peter James Carroll, Nottingham. They wrote about what they know. Jesus wept. O'Brien is that thick. He doesn't get it. It's what we did at weekends, a lot of us, in working class council estates, which is where I grew up. We sat on sofas, beers for the grown-ups, and we watched Noel's House Party and Bruce Forsyth's game shows. People came and went. Of course it appealed to us because it was about us, the Royal Family. We know these characters. Every one of us knows a Jim Royle. Every one of us. And we don't need to be protected from being patronised by idiots who went to the London School of Economics like James O'Brien. You know, does he mean that somebody who grew up in a big country house, went fox hunting, boarding school? I mean, I'm sure they enjoyed the Royal Family, but they hardly identified with the characters, did they? You know, if somebody farted and blamed the wife or the dog or somebody else in my house, we laughed. Yes, it didn't mean we were stupid. It meant we were crass. We laughed. Can you imagine somebody in Castle Combe near Chippenham in Wiltshire or somebody in a village in Buckinghamshire? If someone farted and everybody laughed, they'd call a doctor. They'd call for a shrink, right? It's ridiculous. Of course, you're going to get something different out of the Royal Family if you're from a working class background. And I suppose what Ofcom was trying to say very ham-fistedly when it criticised the BBC was it was asking, do your programmes really reflect the everyday experience? Now, not every programme made by the BBC should reflect somebody's everyday experience. Of course not. God, we want entertainment too. You know, we want to escape. We want a bit of escapism. But some of your programming should speak to people and where they come from and their issues in those areas. But it doesn't. I mean, when was the last time you saw a BBC TV programme dealing with the impacts of mass migration in inner city UK on council estates? Never is the answer. The BBC has never done that. What a ponce James O'Brien is. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Hey, this was scary. Listen to this. I got this from BBC News 24 today, and I've had a little bit of experience with it. Listen, physician associates. What the bloody hell does that mean?
How do you know if you're speaking to a qualified doctor or if the person you're talking to is what's known as a physician associate?
Pay attention, this is serious.
With both roles now coming under the same regulator, there's a warning that patients may get confused. A physician associate is a health professional who plays a supporting role to doctors. They don't have a medical degree and shouldn't make diagnoses unsupervised. Well, the family of one young woman who died after being seen by a physician associate instead of a doctor is calling for more regulation and clarity for patients.
Brilliant. And I had an experience of this last year when they found something on my... Well, I had a chronic bout of what would you call it, bronchitis. And I rang up and I said, I need to see somebody. You know, I might need a little bit of help here. And they said, right, come in. And I went in. And after a few minutes, it occurred to me, the person I was speaking to, it was a woman, and wasn't a qualified doctor. And I asked her, are you a doctor? And she went, no, I'm a physician associate. I said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll leave. We'll make an appointment with the doctor when the doctor is available. So they didn't even tell me that the doctor, I thought I was seeing a doctor, wasn't in fact a doctor, was in fact a physician associate, somebody without a medical degree. And this is becoming more and more common, and more people have no idea they're speaking to somebody. And that BBC report went on to talk about somebody who has died because of this, because they were misdiagnosed. It's crazy, isn't it? It's absolutely crazy. Facebook and Instagram is down, says Claire. Stop the lights, Richie. It's funny you say that, because I was trying to get... I don't have a Facebook account. My mate Rog does, and I use his to do one or two things on Facebook. And for some reason, I couldn't get in. And now I understand it. Thank you, Claire. That's my pal, Claire. Lucy says, Facebook and Instagram has been hit by a worldwide outage, left potentially millions of people unable to access their accounts. Fantastic. I wonder what people will do. I wonder what people will do. Hello to Gary Pears. Hi, Gary. Personalised packaging must be an invitation to shop elsewhere. Then a raffle that the winner can win a chance to destroy the technology on Wasteland, says Gary. It's not bad, Gary. Hi to Gabriel. I've put my takeaway bags and wrappers in the bin on the high road, but shortly after, the local messer takes it from the bin and chucks it on the road. Shortly after, I get a fine and swear that I will never purchase anything from said takeaway again, as do all others captured by this little thought-through net. And shortly after, the whole scheme is abandoned. But Gary, it's not about that. The entry level to the snooping technology is, well, we need to do something about the litter. It then becomes about your everyday habits. It becomes about your carbon footprint, your score. We're all going to have a carbon score one day and one day soon. Rich Mortimer asks, does James O'Brien not understand what working class is? What a T? What? He is, of course, a twat. He's an idiot. He's no brain. He's not intelligent. O'Brien is like many television and radio presenters in the 21st century. They like to lick their own backsides. They like to sit around smugly with dramatic pauses during their delivery, David Brent-esque, so that the audience can, oh, what a genius. He completely missed the point of it. Moron. Of course, if you come from my background, born and bred in Ballybeg in Waterford, and proud of it, goddammit, absolutely right. Wonderful place, wonderful people. When we watched The Royal Family, that was us. That was us. Nobody was patronising us. That was us. Hi to Shane, boys from the Black Stuff. Yes, Shane. Oh, Wiedersehen Pet. Yes, Bread. Bread, the great Carla Lane. She was some writer too, eh? Wonderful. Hi to Grace Ann, who says, Richie, what about the litter that overflows from the bins when they're being emptied? The bin men don't pick up whatever spills. Someone could easily put their rubbish in a bin and it spills out when the bin men don't clean up the mess they make, says Grace Ann. And before you know it, you are in tea rubble. You're in double bubble. Thank you. Okay, 24 minutes it is now past the hour. You can reach out to me via the website, via the app for the programme. I do recommend you download the app. Do download the app, please. Coming up in a few minutes' time, none other than Richard and Fred from Right Said Fred. Massively successful pop, stroke, rock stars. And they're lovely guys too. they were a proper tonic, weren't they, during the course of the last 4 years. Brave to stand up and say the things they said, you know, when others didn't and kept their counsel and held their tongues. Because it does come with consequences and risks when you're very, very, very well known and you are performers and your livelihood is dependent on you travelling and touring. You know, it doesn't come easy, I wouldn't imagine, to stand up and to speak out and to say, look, hang on a second, something is very wrong here. So before we welcome the boys, there is a song I would like you to play. I would like me to play for you, I mean. You can't play it, can you? Not from there. I mean, if you could, that'd be a miracle, wouldn't it? It's a song from an EP that came out in 2021. And I love this song. I played it on the Melodies programme around about 3-4 months ago. It's called Your Inner Light Is Love. What a gorgeous title. The great Right Said Fred on Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Yeah, it's a gorgeous song, that, a couple of years old now. 2021, I think. Your Inner Light Is Love from the great Right Said Fred. Great EP, that. I tell you what, Right Said Fred, 25 million plus records sold, millions and millions of fans around the world, gigs in every country you can think of, and more countries you can't think of. Ivor Novello Awards. I could be here all day talking about the plaudits. Let's welcome back Richard and Fred, the great Right Said Fred. Gentlemen, welcome back to the programme. Thanks for coming on. How are you?
Hey, Richie, how are you?
Thank you very much.
I'm absolutely delighted that you're on. And thanks, Fred, for not being a diva yesterday. I love the fact that you're not a diva. At least that I don't know you're a diva. You might be, but you weren't
we
with
can,
me.
On occasion, we can be.
Yeah, we went through a sort of a blue diva phase. We come out
yes.
But yeah. You came out as well-rounded young men.
Yes,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it so annoyed me yesterday. I mean, I know, and I the reason I know this is because, as well as, I mean, I first came across your music when I was DJing in disco bars in Waterford, in a disco bar with 1,200 people, playing Deeply Dippy, playing Don't Talk, okay. Just Kiss. And I know you're a perfectionist. I'm a perfectionist, so this pissed me off yesterday. But anyway, it doesn't matter. You're here now. Loads to get into with you. And you've probably seen that listeners have been sending me messages, but also little questions for you. What are you up to at the moment? Have you been gigging? Are you touring? Where are you? What's going on in the lives of the Freds?
Right. Well, we've slowly being uncancelled. So, right. So we are out and about this year. We've got a couple of UK festivals. We're in Jam for Freedom festival, which is August 10th, and we're at the Sunshine Festival August 25th. And they're both everything will be on our website in the next week or two. We're just trying to catch up, and we've got some European shows coming in. South Africa's come in, Hungary, where else? Austria, yeah, bits and pieces. So
and a single,
yeah, and then we're literally at the moment we're just mixing off a new record, and that will be we've got meetings with remixers and stuff this weekend, so that should be out. Where are we? April, May, June, I would think.
Yeah, we started working with a guy called Sam Williams, who did a lot of the supergrass stuff and Plan B and stuff like that. And it has come out really, really well.
We're happy with it, yeah.
I didn't really know what producers did until we spoke to Sam.
hang on a second. How could you say that? Because you two are gifted musicians. You can. It's not just bass and guitar. You can do everything. That surprises me now. With your experience, I would have thought that you'd have been a massive exponent of talking about how producers can take great tunes, because you bring a great tune to a producer, and you know that a really good producer takes your really good idea and extrapolates that out, adds things to it, a bit of strings, and makes it amazing, right?
Yes, a good one will, yes.
It's the difference between a cook and a cordon bleu chef, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you can cook, you can throw stuff together at home and it tastes great, and you can eat it, it's all fine. But if you've got guests around, you want something special, you want to go out, it's another notch up. And working with Sam, it was an education for me personally.
Yeah, he's been interesting, yeah. And we're doing some other writing with him. So yeah, that's sort of what we're up to. We're writing some music for a children's project. just trying to come up with a track. And in doing some pre-pro, I've got a TV show at the end of the month, a couple of others booked in, so that's all Germany. And then first show is May, I think.
Hey, listen, by the way, don't wait for me to say Fred or Richard. Just jump in whenever you want. And I'm going to shut up anyway. Yeah, and get out of your way. Talk to me for a few minutes about being uncancelled. Because I said in my introduction, and I wasn't kissing your arses or being overly generous, I was very proud of you back in 2020. I mean, I didn't know you, obviously. But I thought anybody who has had the sort of success you guys have had, and again, you've had huge success. Let's not beat around the bush about that. There are always consequences to when you step away from the herd and you say something different. Yes. So talk to us about that period. And I mean, being slowly but surely uncancelled can't be easy. That talk to me about that.
Well, what happened initially? What happened was that we both naively thought that we lived in a country where you could express an opinion. And so during 2020, we went up to one of the protests in Trafalgar Square, anti-lockdown protests. Yeah. And we went up as observers, really. We didn't really know what we were going to see. So we were just sort of mooching around, you know, Trafalgar Square. It's got the little concrete thing you can sit on, the balustrade, or what we call it. So we were sitting on there and just watching, really. And then we got photographed a few times and papped and stuff, and we didn't think anything of it. And the next day the press just went insane. And the usual idiots, you know, the usual suspects like Piers Morgan, and there was an actor as well, I can't remember his name now, and he lost his mind as well. And they were just appalled that we were there. And then the whole, then we spoke out about the vaccine. It should be a choice. It shouldn't be mandated or coerced. It should just be a choice.
And Fred, it's important to mention here that, in case listeners don't know, when you were saying this, it was being mooted that people would have to have it or they were in danger of losing their job. So that is why you spoke out so strongly at the time.
Yeah, very much. It was no jab, no job. That was the mantra.
What they're saying now is that nobody was forced to get it.
But they were.
But actually, of course, they were. What's going to happen? I think that the medical profession will be left to hang on the vine while the politicians pretend they never actually insisted that anybody would get it. And that if you did get it, it was all to do with the medical industry overstepping the mark. And that there are clips of, there's a particular one clip, I think, in Australia, of a young girl being held, you've seen it.
Physically held down
while she's jabbed. So the idea that people weren't forced to get it, with, as you say, through no jab, no job, no flying, you can't go out, you can't go on holiday, you can't meet your friends, you can't do anything. It was coercion and bullying under another name. That's all it was.
And you two guys, sorry, Fred, you must have been terrified, the two of you, because your careers are travelling around Europe and around the world where you have many fans and playing gigs, and you must have thought to yourselves, holy Mary, mother of God, if this becomes law, we might not be able to gig outside the country again.
That's exactly what we thought. And, you know, I mean, we were very lucky because we've always squirreled away savings and money, but we haven't actually worked. We haven't had a significant job for 4 years coming up. 4 years. Four years. It was February 2020. Well, obviously, we get royalties and we're very, very fortunate, and we're blessed that Beyonce and Drake and Taylor Swift have used our stuff. Yeah. So we're incredibly lucky, and we appreciate that. But in terms of actual getting paid to do something, that changed last year. We got one show, I think, or was it two? I can't remember. And they are coming.
Pay us 10 million.
it was 10 million. That's not bad.
Fantastic.
By the way, Drake has got his own private plane.
Has he?
Yeah. So I don't think he paid us enough.
No, that's true.
I don't think he did pay you enough. And like when you're mentioning people like Drake is one of the biggest selling artists on the planet right now, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift.
Sorry, mate. Sorry.
No, just Taylor Swift as well. You know, to be sampling your work. Amazing.
I think these artists just do numbers that, you know, just out of this world, really. And I don't, I sort of, I can't really get my head around the sort of numbers they do, but we've been very lucky to be part of it, so we're not complaining.
You know, no, you're really not lucky. Lucky is one way of putting it. Hard working, and you wrote some brilliant pop songs. It's as simple as that. And again, I won't say this again. I'm not kissing your arses. They're brilliant pop songs. We're still playing them. If you're somewhere, it doesn't matter where you are in the world or what you're doing, and you're listening to the radio, and it will come on, Radio 2, and they play Deeply Dippy, your mood immediately elevates. There's no two ways about it. It's an amazing song. So well done for everything that you've achieved and all the things you will go on to achieve now. So if I said to both of you, and I want you to talk amongst yourselves here, and I'm just going to listen. I'm going to ride the fader because Richard is a little bit further away from the phone than Fred. But no, it's good. It sounds beautiful. It sounds beautiful.
We've moved it now.
Brilliant. So it's between the two of you. Fantastic. So I sometimes get a panic attack. This is not a joke. There's no punchline. I never had panic attacks before in my life, and I'm a reasonably strong, you know, Irish bloke who can take pretty much anything life throws at him. But every now and then, I get a panic attack thinking back to the madness of the last 4 years. When you guys look back over the last 4 years, how does it make you feel?
I feel disappointed.
Yeah, I'm disappointed.
Really?
I think for me, the most chilling thing was I thought I understood the country I lived in. That's what I thought as I was growing up. I thought I didn't always agree with, you know, various governments and ministers and policy statements and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, you kind of felt that everybody was on the same side in this country. You know, politicians, the courts, the police, medicine, the whole thing. Fundamentally, we might disagree about policy points, but fundamentally, we were all on the same side. I don't any longer believe that, and that's really sad, I think.
Mm. Yeah. I think what's interesting is apart from putting the Great Reset aside, it's been more like the Great Reveal.
It has, yes.
And people have shown their colours, and certainly the music industry has not come out of this very well at all. And I think the other thing that's really sad is the rise in cynicism. People don't believe anything.
No.
You know, you see it online the whole time. Whatever you think of Sunak, or doesn't matter who the politician is, and they might at one point, who knows, tell the truth. But the truth is gone now, it's gone within the tsunami of lies they told in the last 4 years.
Whatever you think of George Galloway, whether you agree with him or not. What's interesting about his election is it further reveals, I think, the huge gap between what ordinary people are feeling, many ordinary people are feeling, and the people in Westminster. I think this gap is absolutely huge now, a gap of perception and the country and understanding of the country they live in. And what I thought was interesting about George Galloway, when he was being interviewed by Sky, he said, "I despise Rishi Sunak." Now, what other MP can you imagine saying that?
Yeah.
Nobody. There's nobody. I think it's going to be a really good shake-up for the House of Commons to have him in it, whether you agree with him or not.
It won't be dull, will it?
No, it won't be dull. No. The House of Commons needs. Personally, I'm a kind of Oliver Cromwell kind of guy. I kind of think, you know, they've sat there for too long. It's time to revisit, you know, the election and have a whole bunch of new people in there because they are all so captured and compromised now.
It's hilarious.
Cromwell got mentioned. Yeah. John Waters, the Irish journalist, gave Cromwell a mention yesterday. He said, "Come back, Cromwell. All is forgiven." Yes. I kind of totally understand that sentiment. But it's a good point you make, Richard, about the cynicism. I've spent the last 10 or 12 years believing that it's controlled, all of it, and it doesn't matter who gets in. Now, if you see it differently, brilliant. Thank God for the show, for the bit of diversity, the bit of good diversity. Do you see it a bit differently than I do? Do you think that you could get change from within the political system as it stands right now?
It would be nice to feel that. I mean, it would be really nice if we had somebody like Peter Shaw on the opposition benches, you know.
Tony Benn or somebody.
I'm a centre-left person. I'm not a radical in any way at all. But what I think is really sad about the Labour Party is it seems to have completely left its base behind. It's just in the same way that the Democrats to some extent have in America, and the Tories have to some extent. Yes, I think it's this disconnect between what ordinary people see on the streets in their communities and in their towns, and the way that it's perceived in Westminster. And so you'll get Rishi Sunak. You know, the only time he wakes up and MPs wake up is when the trouble starts on their own front door. They were perfectly happy to let this whole immigration thing ride along, and they didn't care about the, you know, the problems in Bradford or Rochdale or anywhere else. But then the minute it's on their doorstep, it's like, oh my God, look what we've done. And then you get Rishi Sunak coming out doing his silly speech. It's pathetic. It really is.
I've just crossed my mind that I would think George Galloway must be thinking of fielding more MPs on behalf of the Workers' Party in terms of a general election. They must be thinking that.
Well, they're going after Angela Rayner up here in Stockport because, well, they're going after her for selling her council house. I have to say this, right? Of course, I have no time for any of them. You've got to feel a tiny bit sorry for Rayner. Listen, Thatcher introduced Right to Buy. And like Richard, I'm a bit like you. I would have been a bit centre-left. I would have been a trade unionist. So I would have believed that the country's stock of affordable housing should always be owned by the state and be reserved for those who really can't afford a mortgage. So the fact that people were allowed to buy them, I never agreed with that, even though I grew up on a council estate. People might say, oh, you had no aspirations, Richie. I did. I eventually bought my own house. But anyway, so all she did, Rayner, was buy her council house and then sell it and move somewhere else. But this is one of the reasons she's been kicked from pillar to post this week, and Galloway is targeting her seat. Yeah, that should be fun.
Yes, I saw. Yeah, he wants to oust her.
Well, she hasn't got her majority is not that big.
4,000, I think.
I mean, to be honest with you, Richie, I feel most of these people deserve each other.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. And I'm not aiming that at George Galloway particularly, but it's early days for him. Let's see how he fares. He's already being criticised for swearing allegiance to the king. I mean, I think...
But he has to.
He did
take his hat off.
Yes. But it's part of the, you know... That's how if you become an MP, that's what you're going to have to do. That's just the way it is.
What is your opinion on that? Because I put this tweet out and I was glad to see some opposition. I love an argument, you see. So somebody came back to me and said, Richie, it's just theatre. It doesn't mean anything. It's only theatre. It's only tradition. And if he didn't do it, he wouldn't be allowed to assume his seat and he wouldn't be allowed to speak. My very quick response to that is, I think it's a bit more than theatre. The Crown Corporation and the City of London, I think, is running things. And that would just be my opinion. That's how I see it. How would you see it? Do you think it's just theatre, swearing allegiance to the king, or is it indicative of something more serious? What do you think?
I think it's more serious. I think it's theatre when we watch it.
Yeah.
It's theatre when it happens, but it signifies something deeper, I think. And I think what I think what Fred said earlier about the whole COVID thing is that it was like drawing the bail back. And I think all kinds of people are much more skeptical now about
everything,
landing on the moon, chemtrails, medicine,
banking,
everything. Everything is much more... People are much more cynical about it. Now, you've even got a Labour front bench minister, I'm not sure, or MP, talking about Royal Britannia makes people feel uncomfortable.
Oh, that's the lady with the crazy name.
Yeah.
Thangam
Debonair, yeah.
Yeah, that's Debonair, yeah.
What a name.
It's a good example. People will not leave it alone. And I think we are in a very... You know, in 1975, Peter Shaw said that we're in a very dangerous place, and he was talking about the EEC back then. But I think we are even in an even more dangerous place right now. And the efforts to undermine every single cultural icon, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's wrong, isn't it? I'm an Irish immigrant to this country, and I really love it when people are patriotic here. I nearly bought a pub in Nottingham 10 years ago. And it's a pub called The Pheasant in Radford in Nottingham. And they do a big St. George's Day parade in Nottingham. And I was kind of minding the pub with a view to buying it from Scottish and Newcastle. And anyway, look, I got involved, you know, in the parade. It was great crack. And I really enjoyed that. And I liked it. You know, I like nationalism and patriotism. I think it should be encouraged. But you're quite right, both of you. And I know you're into this and you're right to be into it. They've really made it dirty, haven't they? Or attempted to make it dirty.
Yeah, you'll know, Richard, because you used to live in Spain. And I lived in Barcelona, and in Barcelona, the Catalan flag and the Spanish flag are everywhere.
That's right.
They don't, you know, they hang them from their balconies. They wear them out at night. You know, it's very common to see that, and particularly in the independent protests, it was very visible. And there's no sort of undercurrent. Well, not no undercurrent, but you don't get pointed at. You know, you don't get the white van man sort of accusations. And there's something very strange in the UK where you know, the St. George's Cross or the Union Jack or Union Flag, I suppose you call it, is as you say, it's now a dirty word, and it's that, that is a ridiculous place to be.
I think it, I think it partly stems from the BNP,
a little
who
bit
exploited the flag. But also, I think we've got it in the UK. We're in this kind of self-flagellation period where everything about us, even white skin, is something to be ashamed of now. And, you know, the statue of Churchill has to have a cordon of policemen around it to protect it. We have got into a very odd place in terms of how we view ourselves. And a country that doesn't feel confident in itself, you don't have to excuse your history and the mistakes that were made. Every country has made mistakes historically. So I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that you accept the good with the bad. What you don't do is you don't just focus on the bad stuff. And that's exactly, it started with Colston in Bristol.
But Richard, you make a good point here. This is a very important point. It's almost as if they're claiming that we never discussed these aspects, but that's absolute bollocks. I remember going to Salford University to do a postgraduate TV and radio thing, and Churchill would come up from time to time, and people would talk about Churchill in India, which is obviously not great, right? Okay, nobody attempted to hide this stuff.
No, exactly. That's true.
But also, it's a failure to recognise the simple fact that great men of one kind or another can also be incredibly flawed, and through periods of great either insecurity or wickedness or whatever it happens
to
be.
It's a bad decision.
I mean, what I think was interesting, but certainly if you go back to Churchill, was we sent Chamberlain out, a public schoolboy, to meet a street thug, which is Adolf Hitler. That's why it didn't work. That's why peace in our time was a joke. We sent Churchill out because Churchill was like Hitler. Churchill was a street, he thought he had a street mentality. And that's what you need with some people. But it doesn't mean to say that he was intrinsically evil. It just means he was flawed.
He was flawed.
Every one of us is.
But taking these sort of thumbnail shots of history, people do it for their own benefit, really, just to make
Fred,
a point.
Fred, do you think they do it because you guys have a really good understanding? I think you do, because I follow you on Twitter, so I see what you're doing. You have a good understanding of where they want to take humanity. So the statue's coming down, and the relentless coverage of the culture wars on the mainstream media, for me, it's fairly simple. They want us killing one another over these issues of identity, which are important to us, because they are quite rightly important to us, while at the same time, they're just proceeding, making life ever more controlled and surveilled. Yeah. That's how it feels to me, anyway.
I think you're right. I think that was the underlying message in Sunak's address on Friday, or was it Thursday, whatever it was. And, I think it's just using what he refers to as extremism as an excuse to surveil people, or maybe, you know, harder lines regarding protests and right of assembly, freedom of speech. And that guy the other day has been banged away for 2 years for putting up stickers. I mean, God's sake.
How can that happen in a liberal democracy?
The only thing I'd say is that I think also you can see, I don't comment on politicians' timelines too much anymore. I just can't be bothered. But I do read them. And now, almost without exception, every one of their timelines is negative. They are getting absolutely hammered online. And I think a lot of people are just sick to death of it. And we even get it in the street. We get regular people just coming up saying, you know, didn't always like what you said, but, you know, what the hell's going on now? You know, that sort of conversation. And a lot of people can feel it. They can feel that something's not right. They may not know, and they may not, yes, they'd be, you know, awake or whatever expression you want to use, but people aren't, they can be gullible sometimes, but they're not inherently stupid. And I think people are beginning to think this just doesn't feel right.
I think what's interesting, I mean, I often quote it because I think it's quite an inspirational moment when Peter Shaw addressed the Oxford Union in 75. And what's interesting about that, he was on the I just disagreed with almost everything he stood for, really, because he was on the extreme left, for want of a better expression, of the Labour Party. But he wasn't afraid of being proud of being British. It wasn't a problem for him. Mm. It wasn't a problem for him to talk up the country's history and its contributions that it's made. He wasn't shying away from the problems that we've created. That's also true. But he wasn't inhibited by his left-wingness, if you like. And what's interesting about the Labour Party now is it's almost impossible to find a Labour MP that is patriotic. Lee Anderson in the Tory Party, he merely states what everybody who lives an ordinary life has been seeing. That's all he does. And he's pilloried for it and then makes the mistake of apologising. Mm. That for me is the problem with the left. It is the long march through the institutions. That's what's been happening. And the right, the Tories and the right, anybody on the centre right has been.
Yeah, you mentioned Shaw and Ben. I mean, the Labour Party was traditionally very, very, very suspicious of the European Union. They knew what it would mean for workers' rights and for workers' pay and conditions. So they were opposed to the European Union. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn did the ultimate 180, in my opinion, yes, in the history of social. I don't consider him to be a socialist at all, but didn't he? I mean, he would have been vehemently opposed to the UK's membership of the EU, but then said nothing during and around the referendum. Let me just remind our listeners, you are listening to the great Fred and Richard from Right Said Fred. It's Hello. Wonderful to have the boys back. Hello, gentlemen. And I'm going to read a few quick messages. This from Tim. Richie, the Freds are in our gang. Like us, they stuck to what they knew was right from day one. Yet I imagine with a lot more to lose than most real heroes. God bless them, says Tim. That is lovely. This from Anne. Love what Richard said. The great reveal. Love that term. So true. Kieran is in St. Albans. He says, Richie, great to hear the Freds. Could you ask the lads how they managed to stay grounded over the last 4 years with everything going on? Red wine.
Yeah, well,
red wine, mate.
What we did was we changed the way we worked. We weren't doing shows. So the way we tried to stay sane was we found a lot of like-minded people.
Yeah.
We found a few restaurants that refused to take any notice of the lockdown, so they had these lock-ins.
We had to hide behind pizza boxes.
Yes, we had. Yeah, really did. One restaurant, I won't say who, obviously, but they built this whole wall of pizza boxes.
So we could eat there.
So we could, yeah.
It sounds like Prohibition in the 1920s.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And we found... we bought training stuff for home, which we did.
Yeah,
so we bought a load of training stuff. We had that at home.
The gym was closed.
Then, fortunately, we could work because we could record because you're allowed to go and do your job. So we did that. We released a few tracks. Some did well, some didn't. But Tide was number one. Very proud of that. And we kept grounded by sort of staying away from the madness.
Yeah.
I would not get involved in. I mean, we got didn't get shouted in the street. We got accosted by a couple of local people because we wouldn't wear masks, and that was all a bit weird. But it happened maybe once or twice. But we've never had anyone come up and be rude. We've only ever had support in the street. No one's ever come up and said, "You two bastard, you should say." No, they've never done that. They do it online because keyboard warriors, you know. But we've never had it once in the street. When we did a book tour last year, we had a little bit of kickback from a couple of places. But that was just, it wasn't really a big deal. And of course, we got cancelled. You know, the book came out and we actually got cancelled by the people that published the book. It was extraordinary.
Yeah. Committing financial suicide, the publishers of the book. I mean, it's mad. That's insane, isn't it? That people would.
The book went out. We thought something doesn't feel right, so we bought a load of our own books so we could sell them, because we knew they're not going to do a reprint and they're not going to do any advertising or anything. So we bought our own stock so we can sell it online, which we've been doing.
And we paid for our own advertising.
Yeah, and we paid for, yeah. So we actually, that's proved to be quite a smart move. But we were canned by HMV, Sister Ray, Rough Trade, Waterstones. Who else? Candace. Not was a virgin. Oh. No. Yeah, but basically, it was going to go in the shops. They just pulled it, and we were meant to do a couple of literary festivals, and they cancelled us.
But they cancelled us because they thought we were transphobic.
Yeah, there's this weird guy online. I don't know what he does. I think he's called John Robb, and we were told that he had made a complaint that we're transphobic. And as Richard's boyfriend used to dress up as a woman for a living, so that's all a bit odd.
It's ridiculous. There's never been a band or a group that's ever been more open to people, regardless of where they come from or their sexuality, than Right Said Fred. And I know this. I mean, you couldn't give a damn whether somebody is trans or gay or straight.
You're only interested in, can we have a good time? Do you want to, can we have a beer? Yeah. Are you nice?
Exactly. You know? Our thing is live your life. You know, make the choices you want to make, live your life, but don't expect anybody else to see you how you want to be seen.
All the
just
time,
do
yeah.
your thing, be who you are, and, you know, love who you want, and then take the consequences as they come. When I met my partner, Stuart, in 1982, I had all sorts of abuse because the band was... I met him in 82, the band broke in 91. And I had fag written on my car. Somebody spat at me in the street. Stuart was beaten up in the street. You know, it was rough back then.
It was horrendous back then. But back in 82, when you and Stuart got together, were you very careful when you went out?
Well, weirdly, no, actually, because I didn't think it would be a problem. You know, I remember walking hand in hand down past Stamford Bridge football station stadium. You know, it was only when it's a bit like the same attitude prevailed when we went to the first demo in Trafalgar Square. We didn't think it would be a problem. I didn't think walking down the street in hand in hand with Stuart was going to be a problem. And in fact, when I met him, it was illegal. He was 17. You know, I didn't even think about it. Never crossed my mind for a second. And of course, back he died before we could do any civil partnerships or anything else. But so it was actually pretty rough back then. But I have never had a problem with anybody wanting to live their life as they want to live it. My problem always comes when people try and tell me how to live my life.
Do you get a bit annoyed before Fred comes back in? Because I think this is a very important segue now. Do you sometimes get annoyed? Because I have gay friends who are over a certain age, right? They're my age or older. And when they see younger gay and lesbian women talking about being targeted and stuff, it annoys them because they believe that we live in the most fantastically tolerant society that you could live in. And they say to me sometimes, some of these youngsters, like, when, by youngsters they mean 20-somethings, if they had a taste of what we went through in the 70s and 80s, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true, man. And I had that. I've always... had a soft spot for mixed race or black girls, and I was dating a black girl in the 80s, and we walked into a pub in Gloucester Road, and he said, waiting around for a drink. I said, can I get served? He said, not in here, mate, not with her.
You're kidding me.
No, man, Gloucester Road. Yep, absolutely. About 1983, 1984, I would say.
Jesus Christ, in 84. I mean, we were supposed to be so liberated in 84.
Yeah, seriously, man. No, they wouldn't serve because...
And I worked in a wine bar on the door, and before the shift started, the guy said, if any Arabs come up, it's a private party, don't let them in.
Yeah, that's right.
If any Arabs come up.
Yeah. You think that's the very people you want in there.
Men with money.
Men with money, yeah.
The guys that might order the Cristal, exactly.
Yeah, I think some people now, there are some people out there for whom... their campaign and their suffering is their only companion. That's what it is. They don't know who they are unless they're marching along with a Palestine flag, or marching along with pink hair, or marching along with, you know, the idea of actually simply being you and getting on with your life and making the best choices you can make and love in the best way you can is foreign, I think, to a lot of people. And they only have meaning when they're out on the street shouting about something.
Yeah, but that being said, now I love to find differences with my guests. That being said, you would have applauded those who marched against lockdown. I would applaud those who march against what I consider to be a genocide in Gaza. Now, I know you might see it differently, and of course, that's the beauty of free speech. Of course, I don't agree. If anybody is calling for harm to come to Israelis or to Jews, I'll give them a slap in the mouth if I'm in their company. I'm not having that. But if they want the liberation of Gaza, I think, you know, they're right to go and do that. But Richard, I take your broader point, is that identity politics is suffocating people. I get that.
Yeah. I mean, well, I don't know if you saw it. There was indiscriminate violence. Obviously, I don't support at all. And it seems to me a ceasefire would make...
Discriminate violence.
would make sense. But what I think does happen, and we had it on some of the lockdown marches, and I support these people to go, if they people want to go and march in favour of Palestine or Israel or whatever, that you can't have it both ways. You either support freedom of speech or you don't.
Well said.
One thing that did make me laugh, there was a guy talking in New York, and they had a pro-Palestine march, and they'd run out of Palestinian flags, so they were selling Jordanian ones.
Were they?
That did make me laugh.
The one thing we talked about, actually, Rick, about these marches, is that which makes us both very suspicious, is when you see Westminster Bridge absolutely heaving with people and flags, Palestinian flags, every flag is the same. Every flag is the same size. All the colours are exactly the same tint.
Yeah, where are they coming from?
Somebody somewhere is financing this.
Yes.
Somebody somewhere is organising this. This is not an organic street up, or up from the roots kind of movement. This is an organised and financed position. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if you find out somebody like Soros was behind it or whoever.
Not feel, Richie, that when it kicked off after October 7th, it all felt a bit lockstep? Did you not feel that?
Oh, yeah. I'm open to that. Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the way it was reported and then in terms of the way it happened online. And yeah,
yes.
Richard asks a very good question about the proliferation of these flags. I've wondered about it myself. You know, is there another element to this? Absolutely. Like, while definitely people are horrified at, you know, people, I think all of us should be horrified by the murder of anybody. I wrote an article about this on October 8th. And I said that the price of an Israeli life is just as valuable as the price of a Palestinian life.
Of course,
who could argue with any of that? I've been talking for years about the occupation and the things that go on during the occupation. So I wouldn't have been a Johnny-come-lately to it. But there did seem to be an awful lot to Johnny-come-latelys to this. People who'd never said anything about it before. So that does intrigue me. I'll give you that for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Douglas Murray's position, point was that the Muslims particularly only really care about people being killed when it's Jews doing the killing.
I don't know how true.
Well, he would quote places.
That's his position.
Oh, yeah, I'm saying. But he would quote Yemen, for instance.
I'm going to say, Richard, on that, and I would be a very fierce critic of Douglas Murray, but I'm also honest. I believe in open conversation. Not everybody is wrong or right all of the time. Murray has a very good point because traditionally the Arab nation states couldn't give a damn about the Palestinians, ordinarily.
No, they just don't care
about them. So in that, certainly, he's got a point. And what I find very interesting is my experience of marches for Palestine, and I've attended them over the years, going back to 2014, Operation Protective Edge, you're surrounded often by a lot of Jewish people. And not necessarily ultra-Orthodox, but Jewish people who just can't stand it. And what pisses me off, and we're back to the media again, the media likes to pretend these people don't exist, you know?
Yes, they do.
I know. Yeah. But there's also, people find it very difficult to differentiate between Judaism and Zionism. You see big demonstrations in New York that I saw online of Jews protesting about the Israeli government's behaviour in Gaza, bombing of Gaza. So this is not a simple thing. It's much more nuanced than people think.
Also,
the one thing that does stick in my craw, I have to say, is in amongst as bad as and as awful as what's going on in Gaza is, nobody talks about the 1,500 people killed on October the 7th. All those people have forgotten now.
But not if you're Jewish.
No, but not if you don't. But what I'm saying is, in terms of the media and the coverage that's being given, those people, if 1,500 people, that's at least 3,000 people that have been affected, probably more, families and loved ones and brothers and sisters. So I agree with you, Drew. It's all, killing is just wrong.
It's horrible. I tell you something else, lads. I never, ever, ever engage in whataboutery. I would not argue with that. I have said before, as an Irish Republican, I'm an Irish Republican who never supported the IRA. Why?
Right.
Because the IRA killed innocent civilians. They blew up pubs in Birmingham, in Guildford. They blew up Remembrance Day parades where old men were coming out for the day with their polished medals. How in the name of Christ could you support that? So I didn't.
No, I agree.
Now, if the IRA had exclusively reserved their military activities for the occupying British forces, again, it would be awful, but it could be understood somewhat. If Hamas or any other force that purports to be fighting on behalf of the Palestinians, if they engage the army or the IDF or the Israeli police, you might say, okay, we can understand that the occupation is terrible. The minute that civilians are killed, I've no interest in you at all.
No, I completely agree. Also, someone somewhere is making money out of this. Are they? Guns, weapons.
Yeah, absolutely.
you know, someone somewhere will be profiting from this current horror, and that's another evil that is hard to get your head around, that someone will be looking at their share prices with Lockheed Martin or whoever it is and thinking, oh, that's good.
I just wish British people who go on these marches were as concerned about the homeless and the vulnerable and the elderly in their home country and were as exercised about that as they are about something happening in a foreign field thousands of miles away. I find it odd that we obsess about, as right as it is, I'm not criticizing people for doing that, but we seem blind to the problems we have at home. And that's something that I
find. Now, Richard, to be fair, many of these people might, if they were here, they might argue with you and say, well, hang on, Richard, we didn't agree with lockdowns. We didn't agree with vaccines either. So we are engaged in what's going on. Some of them would say, maybe. So I'm being the devil's advocate there. Can I do a quick roundup? I read a couple of more comments. Yeah. And then, do you know the most common question I was asked to put to you guys today? What? It's about modern pop stage shows. And the propensity for very dark imagery and stuff. Yes. So I'm going to ask you about that because I think you'll have something to say on it. I'm delighted you're here, by the way. I'm having a good week. John Waters yesterday, the lads today. It's easy for me week. So thanks, buddies, for coming on. Cool. The great Wright said, Fred, I don't need to tell you who they are and what they've achieved. Thank you for your lovely messages. Chris came on to say, fantastic to hear the lads. Let's give a shout out to Van the Man and Eric Clapton because they followed the Fred's lead. They sure did. Hi to John in Sydenham. I think it's Sydenham. It's not Sydenham. It's Sydenham, I think. Absolute legends. Great to hear from the Fred, says John. Thanks, John. The lads will be chuffed to hear that. James is in Drogheda. Would the Freds do exactly the same during the next fake pandemic?
Oh. yeah, we would.
Yeah, I think we probably would. I'd probably be...
Even more so, probably.
Well, I'd certainly protest and stuff. My Twitter feed, I might be a little different on the Twitter feed, I don't know. But in principle, probably would, yes. I don't think we're rubbish at playing the game. We're absolute rubbish at it. And I think you just have to go with who you are, really.
Also, the dark imagery thing that you mentioned, Richie, is absolutely true. And I do, when I look at, back at sort of early Bowie stuff.
Richard, don't jump the gun. Richard. I love you. And I know you'll never come on again now because I cut you off in your prime. You'll never come back on this show. Hang on. I'm going to give you a half an hour to talk about this because I have a question that goes before this. I can't wait, Richard, to hear what you have to say. But I just want to read two or three more quick messages. Me getting all domineering there. Do you like that? It's the first time in a while.
Yeah, that's very good.
The wonderful Richard and Fred Fairbrass are our guests. And Richard, I really want to hear about this. The sarcastic window cleaner, please give my regards to the lads. They have been amazing during all of this corona bollocks. Thank you to the window cleaner. Seamus says, Richie, I feel like I need a bit of grounding myself. Could you ask the Freds to recommend a reasonably priced bottle of red? From Seamus, letting us all
I've
down.
I've got one. Hold on, let me go and get it.
Yeah, Richard's I don't drink much red, but Richard does.
Richard is the connoisseur,
a big fan, and he's got a bottle of red here that he really likes.
Okay.
What is it, Richard?
I'll read the label out to you. It's Vino Rosso. It's Papavero, which is Il Papavero, P-A-P-A-V-E-R-O, Vino Rosso, and it's a produce of it. It's an Italian wine.
Well, what I'll do, I'll take a photo of it and I'll tag you on
Twitter. How much? Yeah. How much? Typical Irishman. How much?
Oh, it's not cheap. It's not cheap. It's not expensive. It's about
12 quid, isn't it?
A bit less, I think.
Is it? That's all right.
8.5, 9 quid.
Yeah, not cheap. Not expensive.
No.
If a producer for one of those Saturday morning foodie programs is listening, get Richard Fairbrass on to talk about the wine. He knows his stuff. We heard from Kieran Bill. I didn't think Richard was gay, he says. There we are. Bill has learned something new. Fantastic. Claire says, I proudly fly a Palestinian flag outside my house. There's not much I can do for the Palestinians myself, but flying their flag in solidarity is a small thing. And I suppose Claire would say is that...
That's up to her.
Yeah, and I suppose some people who fly the flag, they might say that it might be a bit unfair. Now, you have not suggested this, but they might say it's a bit unfair to assume that if you fly the Palestinian flag, that you don't give a damn about the Israelis who were killed. Some people might say that, you know, so that's fair as well. Quick one from Sarah. Definitely from someone whom attended marches in London during COVID, during the jabs, never shown on mainstream media, but yet the Palestine marches are shown daily, says Sarah. That's a good point, that. That's a very good point, isn't it?
Yeah, they were ignored, weren't they? Yeah.
Here we go, right? The most common question today was, everybody's fascinated. You watch the Super Bowl, halftime shows, you watch the Grammys, of course, and we see, now, I'll frame it like this. You guys are enormously successful. When you go out on tour, you have a lot to think about. You've got dancers to think about. You've got hotels. You've got venues. You've got everything. Security. You've got to design a show. How many large screens will we have? What props will be on stage? How will the props reflect the songs? I mean, it must be a nightmare thinking about going on a live tour. But the costumes and stuff. So increasingly people talk online, particularly American commentators, about how Satanism and occultism seems to be predominant in live stage shows. I'm shutting up, Richard, if you're still talking to me, that is. What's going on? What's going on?
I think there is a bit. There was a clip the other day of Taylor Swift at some award ceremony, and there was a speaker off camera who decided to, in her speech, thank God. And the minute she said the word God, Taylor Swift shook her head and stopped smiling, stopped waving, and looked really uncomfortable with it. So there is a strange, same with Sam Smith, there's a strange kind of darkness going on there. And I grew up with bands like, David Bowie and early Elton John and stuff, when it was about entertainment and it was colourful and it was fun. And that's why I grew up with that. So this is all actually quite foreign to me.
What I find weird is also how incredibly conservative music's gone. I mean, you've got, loads of, I was watching the thing of Rihanna doing some corporate gig in Dubai and some of the Taylor Swift stuff and other people. And then they're doing this sort of thing where it's just a bunch of dancers or they're sitting on a chair like Lisa Minnelli did in Cabaret sort of was all those years ago. And I find the whole thing a little bit, it's a sort of entertainment you used to see on ocean liners. Yeah. Yeah. It's got a bit cabaret, and I'm not knocking it. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it's a bit weird how it's gone that
bit samey. So when we look at the Elzebub costumes and stuff like that, you guys are, I've never been lucky enough to speak to guys that have done what you've done. So how does it work then? Does the star say, I'd like to look like this for this particular tour? Or do they hire somebody who comes in to say, why don't you consider wearing this or wearing that? Because that's what fascinates me. Who's picking out the costumes or the rig outs, as we say in Ireland?
Well, we used to have a stylist. And when you go out on the road, if you're doing what's called full production, you will have a lighting director. And you'll go through the set with him and you'll discuss lights and the cuts and how you want it. So the artist really should have some input. There's every chance that maybe some artists don't, but I can only tell for what we did.
Yeah.
We know we don't use a stylist anymore. We don't, we did that for a while and we've gone off that. And what we tend to use now are fairly sort of upbeat video screens. We try and avoid dark, but menacing colours. We certainly reds and stuff, just because everybody else is doing it, really. So we would favour more of an upbeat appearance than some of the imagery. The snakes, and we used to use skulls for a little bit because I'd be a bald heads, and so we turn that into a sort of a thing.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't use that either now either. I'm a bit bored.
Yeah, but
it.
Skulls are cool though. I don't think there's anything necessarily dark or evil about skulls. We've always had skulls. Yorick, of course.
We have.
Yeah, yes, going back to Shakespeare. True. Yeah, so I wouldn't mind that. But David Icke said to me years ago, and he's written about this, and David believes that symbols do impact on us, whether we like it or not. And he believed that symbols even make a sound, whether we can hear it or not. And I think he was derided years ago for saying this, but I think he might be onto something. So he reckons that this will have some impact on the people experiencing it. What do you think?
I think that's true. Yeah. I think that's 100% true. And also, I think they know the frequencies, the particularly when you look at the color of the blue of Facebook or the black of X or the brown of Instagram and stuff. These colors aren't just by chance. They've thought about it. They've thought about what impact does that have? They'll focus group it. They'll do everything else and everything else. And I think people know. Certainly the big productions that go along with artists as big as Taylor Swift or Katy Perry or Drake, these people are not silly people. They would have done a huge amount of homework knowing what works.
And also, of course, the label.
Yes.
The label would definitely be involved in that, particularly if Taylor Swift's image would definitely be passed by the label. Absolutely.
The management,
everything else. It would have to be all agreed up front. Because it's a marketing machine.
Yeah.
And one of the sad things about a lot of contemporary pop, contemporary music now, is that it's lost its innocence. It's a marketing machine now. And when we went to America in 1992 with I'm Too Sexy, the first people we met at the radio stations were the accountants.
Yes, right, yeah.
The accountants, Jesus.
The DJ and the people who played the record were further down the line.
I think also sometimes... I don't know about with live performances so much, but I think with videos, artists can get caught out, because you're performing in front of a green screen. And this has happened to us, not on the video so much, but you can lose control. And I'm not defending some of the imagery that's going on. But for example, if you're really busy, you'll do a video in front of a green screen, you go off on the road promoting, and you leave it in the hands of other people. Well, they may not always do what you want them to do.
Yeah.
And we lost control a few times. So I think it can happen. And I think it was Keisha. Was it Keisha? The black American singer. I think she talked about this. Oh, right. But I think live is different. I think pretty much, particularly these big artists, I think they'd be on top of what's happening. And I think they'd be aware of what's happening. And I think if they choose to have serpents and various weird triangle signs and stuff like that, then
pictures of Pete's and...
yeah, then I think they probably are aware of it and what they think it's doing, I can't second guess them.
We've always been a little bit I nearly went to say chaotic. That's not the right word, but we tend not to want to sort of block it out. The show, we get out on stage. I mean, the only thing I know that Fred's on my left, I know the drummer's behind me, and and I'm at the front, and there's some basic sort of positioning that goes on. But broadly speaking, we don't really choreograph the show.
No, we don't.
We never really think.
I couldn't remember anyway.
And, I mean, really.
You're not that bloody old. By the way, the Freds, of course, one of their many achievements, the first British band to have a number one on the US Billboard Hot 100. After the Beatles. What an amazingly wonderful thing. Great company to be in. Now, I wanted to ask you about this. By the way, we can go till 6:30. I'm on till 6, but you're under no obligation to stick around. I know you have plenty to do and you're busy, right? But I wanted to ask you about something. I don't like to be negative in any radio show I do, but I was disturbed by something I heard recently. Listen, when I was old enough to go out, 15, 16, sneak into nightclubs with fake ID, which I did, I didn't have to use a fake ID too often because I'm a tall, kind of rangy type of lad. But live music was all I was interested in, watching A House, Something Happens, The Stunning, all these Irish rock bands of the 80s and 90s, Aslan, of course, Christy Dignam, all these bands. I love it, love me live music. And... you'll know this story, won't you? Because it's been in all the papers. Venues that would have been ideal for new emerging bands to go and play their music, they're disappearing all over the country. And I have a great friend, I often mention her, Jean Ann, a hugely successful actress, wonderful woman, beautiful woman, has done it all, TV, radio, everything, stage. And she reckons they're going after the souls of people by killing theatre and by killing live music. Do you feel like that? How serious is this thing with venues closing all over the place?
Well, the thing with venues closing is very serious. Mm. And I think part of the problem is, I think it's a whole mixture of things. This may not be a very popular thing to say, but the smoking ban didn't help live venues. Price of a pint, VAT on tickets and stuff like that, and also the whole reality and the talent show thing hasn't helped, because people start to see there's a very interesting, I posted it today by James Blake, and he thinks people have been brainwashed into thinking music is cheap and free. And I think part of that, it comes from streaming, part of it comes from social media, and some of it comes from the talent shows, because it's only a certain type of music that ever gets aired on those shows. So, and I think that hasn't helped with small venues, because when I was a kid and through the 80s, you were really curious about bands. You know, you'd hear about a certain band, you go, well, let's go and have a look at them. And now, what do you do? Maybe you go on YouTube, or maybe you go on their website or their Twitter feed instead. I don't know. But live venues and their lack of is a huge issue in the UK.
And in Ireland.
Yeah, the actress you mentioned, you're talking about taking people's souls away. I think in a way that there's an element of truth in that. And it's a little bit like the COVID thing, I think. I'm not one of those people who thought that COVID was a hoax, but I do think it was exploited. And I think that I think it's in the same way that venues closing down is being exploited. One thing that politicians cannot control is a bunch of people having a good time. They can't control it. They don't know what to do with it. So that's why they close pubs. That's why they're closing down venues. That's why they have no interest, really, I think, in the ordinary pleasures of ordinary people. I think those things are a problem for them, because it gives ordinary people a sense of power, their own empowerment, which is a problem for people who want to control you.
Richard, you remember this as well, Fred. When you go to a gig, you know, I've not seen you guys. I nearly saw you at Pride in Manchester a couple of years ago, and it didn't happen. But I can't wait till I get to see you guys play and to meet you and say hello to you and buy you some of that nice red wine, Richard, and whatever Fred is having. But it's transcendental. Look, we go to a lot in Manchester, so it doesn't matter where it is. My missus and myself, she's a very accomplished musician. I'm not. I can play a few chords on the guitar, but she's a real musician, right? Clarinet, piano, and saxophone. She might audition for the Freds one day, who knows? But she's very good, and we love it. It gives you days and days of positive energy and love to be in a room. I'll give you an example. Went to see Madness in the Arena just before Christmas. To be in a room where everybody is laughing and smiling and singing the choruses, and you've had it, because you yourselves have got a string of hits with great choruses. People will go and see the Freds, and it will set them up. It is food for the soul, not music for the soul. And it is healthy, and it is healing, I believe. And that's what they're going after, I think.
I think art generally is It's an arena that should be as free as possible. But anything that's free, that's emotionally free and spiritually free, is a threat. It's not something that is welcome, but in certain circles. So when you'll see, if you talk about the WEF, for example, when you see those people talking, people like Schwab or Harari, they never talk about art. They never talk about love. Never talk about spirituality.
No, never.
They never talk. It's the world economic form. It's money. That's what matters.
And control.
So
didn't the Greeks, sorry to interrupt you guys, kick me in the arse for interrupting you, but didn't the Greeks, again, thinking back to my pal, she's told me this, the Greeks put their theatres next to their hospitals, didn't they?
I don't know.
For the very reason we've been discussing, because it would greatly improve and expedite, I suppose, persons' healing when they came out, yeah.
Right. I didn't know that.
That's a good idea. Okay. I mean, I'm never... The two times I'm really, really happy is either on stage or today when I was in the gym and I've got earpods and I've got all my favourite music blasting in my head. I absolutely love it. And I think other people in the gym must think I'm bloody bonkers because I'm dancing around and singing to myself.
You know what they really think, Richard? They think, Jesus, that guy can't sing. How in the hell? How in the name of God did he make it with that voice? But no, you obviously can sing. You've got a great baritone set of pipes on you there, Richard and Fred. Let me read a couple of more comments. And if you want to do a few more minutes, and then I'll let you go then, because I know you've got plenty going on. But the comments are lovely. I'm getting a bit of stick for not pushing back against you on the Palestine thing. But my listeners, I haven't taught them. You see, I've been trying to teach my listeners for years. I've been bitching about Israel. and Zionism for weeks on the show. I'm not pushing back that hard because my listeners know what I think and they're hearing a different side of it. So I don't have to push back against the Freds. I see Israel and Palestine a bit differently than the guys do. They're entitled to their opinion. And thank God we still have places where we can exchange ideas and views without falling out with one another, you know. So there you are. Zach says, when they ask why are the protesters not bothering about the British old age pensioners, etc., the answer is because the pensioners are not being shelled or starved or facing genocide. That's Zach's opinion. Thank you for that, Zach. This one is from, let me just bring this up. This one was from Petra, I think. Petra went to see you guys, she says, in Milton Keynes years ago. Doesn't say which year now. Says it was one of the greatest nights she ever had in her life. She was singing the songs for days afterwards, talking about that experience of being in a crowd with a great band and the energy. Petra, Milton Keynes, whenever that was.
Okay.
I can't remember.
So just very quickly, go back to the other comment about the pensioners and or homeless aren't being bombed and attacked.
Zach's
opinion. Well, but they are. But they're not bombed, but they are being attacked. They're being attacked through huge increases in cost of living. We work with a couple of homeless charities, and I can tell you that they are being attacked. They're being attacked because people don't have the money in their pockets to be generous. They're being attacked because they're being kicked out of homes in favour of new arrivals, let's say. And they're being attacked because they are becoming more and more invisible. So they are being attacked. I completely agree. It's not the genocide, and I'm not trying to compare it, but it's important that we remember both of these people.
Yeah, but it's also important that people understand that on many issues, particularly issues that geopolitical issues overseas, that the majority of people, it's not that they're uninterested, but they are moderate. They take the position as you took, that all lives are sacred and that you can't ignore the fact that Israelis were killed on October 7th. And that's the majority. And like, I would be very anti-Israel. All my, you know, anybody who knows me knows that I've no time for the state of Israel and what it has done in 75 years. And I'd be very vocal about that. But I also accept that a lot of people take a more moderate stance than I do on it. And I don't feel that I have the right to browbeat them into seeing things as, you know, acutely as I see them. It's just not the way it is for me. I used to be that other guy where I would have been screaming at you, you know, well, they're killing people and all that. But that's nonsense. It doesn't get you anywhere, you know. No, so that's how I approach it. But yeah.
Yeah. Some of the, on Twitter particularly, you'll see there's a whole thing about their, you know, how the Israelis, they're bombing children, killing children. And my, which is awful, obviously awful. But to me, all lives are the same. Whether an 80-year-old woman gets killed or an 18-month-old baby, it's all the same.
Yeah.
This league table of life worthiness, I find a little bit distasteful, to be honest. All lives are sacred. And I find it weird that we tend to measure one life as being more important than another. And also, going back to the Palestinian and the Israeli thing, it is such a convoluted and difficult thing to get your head round. For me, it's like the war in the Balkans. It's like abortion. There are some issues that are so nuanced and so complicated and so historically difficult to untangle that I don't feel qualified in a way to be sort of staunch on one side or the other. I can only say that what's going on in Gaza is absolutely bloody awful, and so was October the 7th.
You're entitled to say it, Richard. You're entitled to say that you're a man of peace and that nobody should be killing anybody. It's as simple as that.
Exactly.
And you mentioned the military intelligence. Sorry, you mentioned the military-industrial complex earlier on, which is a point well made too. I recommend our listeners will watch a film. I'm sure you've seen it. Nicolas Cage's Lord of War, which is one of the most important films ever made about that whole industry. Hey, listen, a couple of more minutes then, just before we do go. We're excited about the new single. And you're working with the new producer. You mentioned his name, who did a bit with Supergrass. So that's exciting.
Sorry?
So that's exciting. And then you have festivals coming up later this year. So you've got plenty going on.
TV in Europe and a couple of festivals in the UK. And I think it'll pick up with the new record. It's just, you know, the Having been cancelled is now thawing, and but it will take probably into next year to catch up.
I think what it was actually, Richie, I think partly it's because we broke as a kind of fluffy, friendly family kind of, you know, a slightly sort of pinky innocent sort of thing. We weren't, you know, Tom York. We weren't, you know, Elbow or something. And I think what happened was the reason we got slated very heavily was because what we said wasn't consistent with the way we broke.
Yeah, we didn't stay in our lane.
We didn't stay on our lane. And I don't think that irritated a lot of people. Yeah.
I don't think so. Ultimately, there's any such thing as bad publicity. Now, you've had great careers, but I think what it has done, and this must be the case, it has definitely alerted a new audience or introduced you to a new audience. It must have done. All this cancer.
It has, yeah. Also, it's changed the people we work with. There's some musicians now that we used to work with, we just couldn't work with now. And that probably applies, they probably feel the same about us. But we've met a whole bunch of new people. And that's what it does. You know, every action has a reaction. And, you know, you go through different periods in your life. And I'm rather hoping the last 4 years is the last we see of it. But I don't think it will be, but it would be nice if it was.
I remember when we went on the march, right at the very beginning, people used to think the marches were about changing government policy. And I never felt that. But what I did feel, and I remember talking to a little old lady on one of the first marches we went to, and she was from Southampton, and she said that she had never been in the company of so many people who agreed with what she felt. That in Southampton, all her friends thought she was bonkers. All her friends either left, didn't want to talk to her, or whatever. She felt completely isolated. So for her, the marches were really beneficial. They were really, really, and that's what it was. And that's what, when Fred was talking about the reactions we get from people, it's a kind of mutual support thing. So that people who perhaps felt they were going mad or they were on their own or whatever, felt that there were people out there, us and other, obviously lots of other people, who were on their side and reflecting what they thought. So that was a learning curve and a really good one.
Too. Yeah, you might not be completely aware of how important it is for people in a situation like that, when well-known people. It's one thing when you tune into a radio show and you got a gobby Irish guy or somebody else, you know, trying to break it down and say this isn't right, but there is that sense of, oh, thank God I'm not going crazy then, when absolutely, you see Right Said Fred and, you know, you see Van Morrison. That's very important, that. And that's why it was such a big deal, you guys doing it. And can I just say this? I know I've said it previously when we spoke previously, but I don't do it very often because I do like to push back a bit more with my guests. But I want to say thanks for doing it. Thanks, because you kind of made it a bit easier as well for broadcasters like myself to get into it, you know, and to bring it to more people. Because I could say, well, look at what the lads are doing. You know, these guys are not idiots. They have careers and, you know, and they're asking questions about it. So just thanks, guys. Well done. And if you want a quick final word each, have that final word. And nothing but love and respect to both of you, and continued success with the single and with the live gigs this year. And please, God, before too long, you'll be up here in Manchester, and then I'm going to have the night of my life.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Well, thanks for that, Richard.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Also, I just think it's important to remember there's more that unites us than separates us. And I think if we could all of us focus on that, that it might make life a day-to-day life a bit easier.
Yeah, and sometimes you just need to be brave. You just need to think for yourself and be brave. It's simpler than you think.
You're a gift, the two of you. Best of everything this year. Thanks for coming on today. You've been listening to the great Fred and Richard Fairbrass of Right Said Fred. Thanks, guys.
All right,
thanks, Richie.
Thanks, Richie. Lots of love, mate. Take care. Mate.
You too,
mate.
Guys. Thanks for that. Brilliant stuff. Brilliant. Loads of comments, so I'll read them after we hear another track from the two lads. Right Said Fred and Don't Talk, Just Kiss from the 1992 album Up, which was a mega seller with Deeply Dippy and I'm Too Sexy amongst the singles. Wasn't that interesting what Richard said about going out with his boyfriend Stuart in 1982 in areas that you might have imagined back then would have been no-go areas? And he said he held his hand and never had any problems. And I wonder, is that about energy? Is that about, you know, creating the world around you through your thoughts? You know, confident going out, not expecting any trouble. I'm going out with my boyfriend and we're going to have a good night. And thinking of that, leaving the house with no negativity in your head. Because it's interesting, because I know, as I said, older gay men and some women, and they would have encountered violence in the 80s. You know, if anybody got the drop on them, if anybody thought, oh, they're together and they're same sex. Jenny says, yesterday and today, Richie, if only we had world leaders of the same intelligence and feelings as Jenny. Amen, Jenny. Hello to Jim. Jim says, Richie, since lockdown, I haven't finished one of my art paintings. The frequency is difficult to get to finish it. In the past, every dictatorship always targets artists, says Jim. And he's with Trudy in Staines. Good evening, Jim and Trudy. Isn't that interesting, Jim? That there was an oppressive feeling and energy. I felt it big time. And I used to scoff at people who talked about energy, you know. I did. When I say scoff, I was never rude or obnoxious. But privately, I would have thought people who talked about energy healing, people like my mate Peter and my mate Mark and others, I'd have thought this is a bit airy-fairy for me. But I felt it in 2020, 2021. I sometimes feel it today. And I reckon that people who are open to it, people who are very spiritual, they must have suffered quite badly, particularly through 2020 and 2021. So thanks for that, Jim. And maybe you'll finish that painting, pal. Maybe the energy will be right soon enough for you. Busy says, we wanted tickets for Pearl Jam in Manchester last August, or this August maybe. The cheapest tickets are £160. This disgusts me also. I've read a number of magazine articles about it. A lot of what you might call legacy artists, so bands who are huge in the 70s, 80s and 90s, they're not making as much money when they release CDs or vinyls because of streaming services and the availability of streaming services. So they are making their money effectively by demanding massive guarantees up front from promoters, from ticket sale agents like Ticketmaster, but also promoters who work with the likes of Ticketmaster. So Pearl Jam might, I can't speak for Pearl Jam because I don't know if this is the case, but I do know it's the case for U2. Now on U2's last tour, they said that this is not the current, they're in Vegas in this crazy technological splendor of a sphere. But forget that. The tour they did previously, they demanded £250,000 each per show. So £1 million had to be found to pay the band. You had the venue hire, you had security, you had insurance, everything else that goes with it. So tickets at the arena in Manchester when U2 came around, they were over £240 a ticket, which is disgusting. It is disgusting. How much is enough? You know, each of the members of U2 is worth about £200 million. What about playing for the fun of it, like? What about playing where you get maybe £50,000 each? Is that not enough for you for a night's work, or £25,000? If it means that the punter who's bought all of your albums and followed you around the world for 30 years, if they can pay £35 for a ticket. It is disgusting, this. It really is disgusting. And it is getting worse, and we're seeing it. Because I'm always on the website looking to see who's playing in Manchester next month or next year, and if I want to go. And increasingly, as I said, the prices are absolutely prohibitive. It's like, Jesus Christ, no, we can't afford that. So you're not going. Brian reckons the most he'd pay is £30. Yeah, fair enough. And ironically, back in the day, when you two were younger, and when they were hungry, they, much to the annoyance of their manager, Paul McGuinness, they insisted on the ticket price being affordable, even though the cost of staging the gigs was becoming more expensive. They ran a tour in the mid-1990s called the Potmar Tour, where they took the biggest screen in the world around the world. But they had to have two of them, because it took 3 days to set up each venue. And they insisted to Paul McGuinness, the manager, that the ticket prices be no more than £25 per person. And McGuinness said, but we're not going to make any money then. because staging this thing is costing £200,000 a day. And the band, to their credit at the time, this is before Bonio went full, what did I call him? Peak bollocks. Before he went peak bollocks, Bonio. They said, no, our fans can't afford to pay £50 a ticket. So it's going to be £25 and that's the end of it. Not anymore. Now they want £250,000 each before they get on stage. The bastards. Hi to Nelly. Loved hearing Fred and Richard Ritchie. It's like sitting around a table in the pub with some good friends putting the world to rights. I really loved it. Thanks, Nelly. That's very kind. Hi to Jan. I've been in Cuba, Richie. There were loads of small bands in small restaurants and bars. They all had old instruments and some had homemade instruments. It was wonderful. The music reached right into your soul, says Jan. Thank you, Jan. That's lovely. Christine said the Freds are so right about the arts. My granddaughter is doing art at college, and an art teacher told me a couple of weeks ago they don't want students doing the arts as they tend to be critical thinkers when they come to college. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Yeah, I can buy that, Christine. Karen says homelessness will become such a big issue if and when we eventually move to digital currency. I truly worry about how it will affect them, says Karen. Thank you, Karen. No doubt. And Kieran says, thanks for discussing Gaza with the guys. I'm also concerned for the elderly, British towns and racial peace in Europe because of a massive influx of Palestinian refugees and asylum seekers when they are driven out of Gaza. Nobody is talking about this. Their neighbours have taken enough refugees. Where are they going to go? Asks Kieran. Yeah, that's another good point. I think the Israeli government would prefer that the Egyptians took them in and then they could seal off that border and occupy Palestine once and for all. That would be my opinion. Hi to Colin G. He says, Busy is right about the price of concert tickets. It's outrageous lately. Any tickets for under €100, they've become a rarity these days. That's right. Now, we bought tickets, myself and the missus, to go and see the Mavericks in April. They're in the Bridgewater Hall. And I think the tickets were £40 each, I think. And that's a wonderful thing because the Mavericks give you a fantastic 2.5 hour show. Their music is wonderful. They're a joy. You'll be on cloud nine for the best part of a fortnight after the gig. And £40 each for the tickets in good seats is bloody good value, I say. For the Mavericks, for Raoul Mallow and the wonderful Mavericks. Yes, I'm looking forward to it. The Bridgewater Hotel. Your BBG won't be able to talk for days afterwards. Ian reckons it's the case of like it or lump it with you too. If you are stupid enough to pay that price, tough shit, you're not being forced to pay, says Ian. But that's not the point, Ian. It isn't the point whether you're being forced to pay or not. You know, it's important to people to be connected to the music that they loved when they were younger. And it's a joy to go and see a band as they've aged, as you've aged, that you went to see in the 80s or 90s. It's a joy to go and sing the songs that you grew up loving. And it'd be nice if you could do that without the artist in question taking your trousers down and giving you one from behind. It's not the point. I hear you, but it's not the point. You know, the point is, these artists, many of them, they don't even need the ticket money, really. So go and do the gigs. You know, charge a fair price, and you might find you're getting a much better reaction from the audience. I went to see U2 at the arena, and I paid, at the time, I paid £180 each for two tickets, and it killed me doing it. It really did, because it's not me to spend that kind of stupid money. And here's something I noticed. There was a very limp reaction from the audience that night. They played the hits. They played the Achtung Baby songs. They played the Unforgettable Fire songs and what have you. But there wasn't much energy in the crowd. And maybe that had some bearing on, or it had some relationship with, the fact that the ticket prices were so expensive. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Paul says, I saw U2 and Croker, paid around £50, which I thought was reasonable. Would watch them now, though, if they paid me. Yeah, I will never go and see them again. I will never go and see them again. Thank you for all of these messages, by the way. It's lovely to hear from you today on the programme. What am I going to do now? Well, that's not right, is it? Is it? Is that right? It is right. Seems to be right. Okay. A different Ian. Have you ever seen Gary Newman live? I've seen him maybe a dozen times, says Ian, between Birmingham, Nottingham and Wolverhampton. He has amazing energy and stagecraft. No, I haven't, Ian, but he's been in Manchester several times. He's been at the smaller O2 venue, the Ritz, in Manchester, in central Manchester. And I thought about possibly going to see him, but it never worked out. You're listening to The Richie Allen Show. It is genuinely the most listened to independent news radio show in the world. I very rarely request from you that you support the programme, but I'm doing it today. Please support your show.
Ask not what the BBG can do for you, but what you can do for the BBG. Support The Richie Allen Show now at richieallen.co.uk.
Now, there's been a fairly significant drop in support, right, in recent months, which hasn't coincided with the drop-off in listeners. There's been no drop-off in listening numbers. In fact, it continues to attract new listeners all the time. The programme, as you know by now, is doing ridiculous numbers, particularly on Apple's iTunes, Apple Store, whatever you want to call it. It's holding its own with some of the biggest names in the mainstream media. But I understand that people are struggling really badly. I do get that. And I've said this before, you know, if supporting something like this is a bridge too far for you, if it's a stretch too far because your finances are not great, I totally get it. But if that isn't the case, if you are doing okay and you do listen to this, it's something that the boys said earlier on about their own music. It isn't free. This is a full-time job. And it costs a lot of money to put this on. A lot of money. Okay? Streaming costs, of course. Hosting. Everything else that goes with it. And I'd like you to support it. If you go to richieallen.co.uk, if you go to my website, richieallen.co.uk, there are bank details, Halifax bank details for Manchester for the programme, and also Patreon. I would prefer you use the bank account because Patreon are taking an enormous chunk. Their own cut is outrageous, and that's not good, right? I'd prefer they didn't take any cut at all. But I'm asking you to support it. If it's important to you, if this programme is important to you, if you need it. One of the reasons I did the podcast in the mornings was to give something extra. When I saw there was a drop-off in financial support for the programme, even though there was no listener drop-off, I thought, well, I'll meet you halfway. I'll give you something a bit extra. And I'm giving you a lot now. You're getting 5 podcasts every morning. And they're doing quite well in terms of a lot of people are downloading them. And I'm giving you the live radio show Monday to Thursday and the music show on Sunday. So please support it if you can. And if you can't, tell me to feck off, and I'll totally understand it. But we do get a bit lazy, all of us do, me included. We forget sometimes when we listen to something and we like it, and you know, and we're not being charged for it. There is a cost in accord with that. This is my full-time job. I'm at this about 80 hours a week. That is not an exaggeration, by the way. And it needs your support, so please do support it, all right? This is rare, isn't it? Me saying support the show. I won't mention it again for another 6 months. I trust that you will. So please do. Okay. Enough from me. Seamus Connolly asks this. Does Larry Mullen's bad back cost him some of the quarter mil when he's a no-show? He's currently resting up and they have a Dutch drummer working with them. I have a conspiracy theory about this, Seamus. I believe that Larry Mullen is sick and tired of Boneyo. And I'm going to be proved wrong because I'm always wrong when it comes to my conspiracy theories. But if Larry Mullen sits behind the drums for U2 again, I'll be very surprised. I think he's had enough of Bono's bullshit. That is my suspicion. I'm not saying he hasn't had problems with his back and his hands, because he has. He definitely has, right? But I think he's had enough. Who could blame him if he has? Seamus went to see Sting at Delamere Forest in the summer, wanted to go, with the missus, wanted to go until I observed the ticket price. Preferred to see the up-and-coming bands these days. Yes, and we shouldn't blame it on... The blame must be placed squarely at the feet of the artist. They're telling the promoters, yes, yes, I will come and play these gigs you want me to play, but I want this massive upfront guarantee. And that is leading to the ridiculous ticket prices because the promoter has got to make some money and so on, so on. It's awful. Yeah, it's horrendous, really. But what are you going to do? Claire says, Stiff Little Fingers, the great Stiff Little Fingers, think alternative Ulster. Cheap tickets, always amazing concerts, says Claire. So there is good value and good bands. A few years ago, just before the great Pete Shelley passed away, God have mercy on him, I took Froggy to see Buzzcocks in Manchester, and I think we paid £24 each for the tickets. And it was a brilliant show. Now, the sound wasn't great on the night, not because of the band. It was in that venue, which is beautiful, but the sound is awful, the acoustics. I can't remember the name of the venue. Horrible acoustics, but brilliant performance by the band. £24 each, happy days. And the venue didn't charge you £7 for a pint either. It was, you know, normal prices. This was pre-COVID bollocks, of course. Of course it was. Listen, thank you so much to the great friends, Richard and Fred Fairbrass. Thank you for listening. I've been Richie Allen. Back tomorrow at 4 o'clock for the Richie Allen Show. But the other podcast I've mentioned already will be on air. It won't be on air. Jesus wept. It'll be online tomorrow. It'll be online tomorrow. It'll be online tomorrow. I don't know what that was. About 7 a.m. in the morning. All right, okay. All right. Time for a cold beer, I think. Think I've earned it. Maybe I haven't. Thanks for listening. Bye now.